From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. That is the late Sudanese singer and musician Mohamed El Amin. He plays the oud, a type of stringed instrument common in North Africa and the Middle East. We're opening with this music today because Sudan is the subject of our program. In 2019, Sudan's military overthrew dictator Omar al-Bashir. He had ruled the country for 30 years, and the coup d'etat brought hope for many in Sudan. But in 2023, a civil war broke out. A group known as the Rapid Support Forces took power. The paramilitary group has been called Arab supremacist, and they enacted mass violence across the country, specifically on Sudan's minority black ethnic groups.
An emergency session of the United Nations Human Rights Council has unanimously approved a formal investigation into allegations of a massacre last month in the Sudanese city of El Fasher. Earlier, the UN Human Rights Chief, Volker Turk, described the atrocities as a stain on the record of the international community.
That report from the BBC Global News podcast. The BBC separately reported more than 150,000 people have been killed in Sudan, and an estimated 12 million have been displaced. This January, as the Biden administration was winding down, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken went even further than the UN. He said, "I have now concluded that members of the RSF and allied militias have committed genocide in Sudan." Despite the tremendous human catastrophe unfolding there, what's happening in Sudan has not received nearly as much attention as what's happened in Ukraine or Palestine. And today on the show, we'll begin by exploring why that is and learn some of the history and context behind the news. Later in the hour, we'll talk with an Illinois comedian who was born in Sudan, immigrated here as a child, and grew up in the Quad Cities. We begin with two guests who have long been invested in Sudan. Swad Abdel Aziz is a human rights lawyer and executive director of the group Decolonize Sudan. Swad, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And John Prendergast is co-founder of The Century. It's an organization that investigates and seeks to disrupt global networks that enable violence, like what's happening in Sudan. He's also founding director of The Enough Project, which aims to end mass violence in some of Africa's conflict zones. And finally, John was Director of African Affairs at the National Security Council under President Bill Clinton. John, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, and thanks for covering this as well.
And I should say, Swad and John recently co-wrote an op-ed published in the New York Times. The title was "Sudan is in Freefall." We'll put a link to that at our website, 21stshow.org. You can join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. All right, Swad, I'm going to start with you. What brought your family from Sudan to the U.S.? When was that?
Yeah, thanks again for having me. We came as refugees from Sudan in the early 2000s when I was a teenager. And so, you know, we, of course, like many other Sudanese communities, we sought a better life. My family sought, basic opportunities for their children. That's what brought us to the United States.
What are some memories you have of living in Sudan?
You know, the main thing that I think of when I think of Sudan is the communal living amongst extended family and the kind of community support that neighbors provide one another, and that family members and this extended family that is Sudan, the kind of love and support that Sudanese people show one another. My earliest memories were of, my grandmother, God bless her soul, feeding all of the neighborhood kids. For us, our home and my grandmother's home was a community hub, and she was really a matriarchal source of community support. She is very much acted as such an anchor to our community. So losing her within this past 2.5 years was really not only devastating to our family, but to our larger communities within Sudan.
And when was the last time you had the opportunity to visit?
The last time I visited was immediately before 2023 and late 2022. And that was immediately before the RSF siege began in April of 2023, which really changed everything. It changed all of our lives and the lives of Sudanese people all over the world. And so to see, I still see Sudan from those eyes, you know, that perspective pre-2023, where Sudan was, you know, for the most part, you know, the people were, you know, suffering under, you know, poor economic conditions, but our people were thriving and our communities were thriving. And so it's really a loss to all of us what we've experienced in the past 2.5 years.
John Prendergast, what about you? What are your connections to Sudan, and when were you last there?
Well, my time goes back to the 1980s when I went in from the neighboring country of Kenya. Sudan was still a country that encompassed the current nation, the newest nation in the world, South Sudan. And there was a war going on between the North and the South of Sudan. And so I regularly began traveling by 1986, 87 from neighboring Kenya and neighboring Uganda into Southern Sudan, as it was called then, just basically providing aid and doing human rights monitoring. I also went across the border from Chad into Darfur in Western Sudan in the late 80s and early 90s, in my earliest time in Sudan. And then just spent the last 35, 40, whatever year, number of years it is, going back and forth. I lived for a little while in Southern Sudan before it became an independent nation, working for UNICEF. And up till about 2014, 2015, I was able to go into Darfur via Chad, across the border, into areas not controlled by the government. I haven't been able to get a visa from the government since the early 2000s. That's as a result of sort of all the human rights reporting and advocacy that I've done related to the conflict and related to the atrocities that have been committed there. But I've remained committed over these years to trying to support peace and human rights and transition to democratic rule for now almost 40 years.
So we could probably spend an hour alone just on the history and the backstory, or maybe several hours of it. But Swad, maybe you can just give us a little bit more information on what happened in 2023 and what the current dynamics are in Sudan.
Yeah, so since April of 2023, the Rapid Support Forces, which is a private militia group, that is an offshoot of the Janjaweed Militia Alliance, responsible for the Darfur genocide in the early 2000s. This militia has waged a campaign of genocide and ethnic cleansing marked by mass killings, forced displacement, torture, sexual violence, leveling and destruction of infrastructure, and the deliberate starvation of entire communities. Why Sudan is called the largest humanitarian crisis going on in the world today is simply because of the scale of the destruction and the violence the Sudanese people are experiencing. Millions have been displaced. Entire communities have been erased by the RSF. And of course, infrastructure destruction and destabilization of the Sudanese economy has completely destroyed the lives of many. As particularly this past month, those communities within the Darfur and Kordofan regions have been targeted by the RSF within this campaign of annihilation in order to take over the lands. This is the most resource-rich land in Sudan, and of course, where the gold mines, the majority of the gold mines within Sudan, are located. Last month, after receiving a supply of sophisticated UAE weaponry a little over a month ago, The militants, the RSF militants, took over the city of El Fashid and executed one of the largest mass killing events of the 21st century within a five-day period. Leading up to this extermination campaign of the city of El Fashid, the RSF militia trapped civilians within El Fashid, over a quarter of a million civilians within what Yale Humanitarian Research Lab dubbed a kill box, forcibly starving besieged civilians and not allowing civilians to escape. So what the RSF has done in El Fashir over the past 5 days signals a really dangerous trend of impunity that, if continued, the RSF, if allowed to continue by the international community, and not only allowed to continue, but the arms flow that makes this happen continues to flow into the RSF through the United Arab Emirates. What Sudan is facing is total annihilation and complete destabilization. So I hope that your listeners understand kind of the scale of what's happening, and look into the kind of atrocities that are being committed by the Rapid Support Forces.
John, I mentioned that piece in the New York Times. It's called "Sudan is in Freefall." In it, you and Swad and another co-author write, "This slaughter could potentially be stopped if those with leverage would apply pressure on the United Arab Emirates, the primary backer of the Rapid Support Forces war machine. Those include American leaders like President Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and behemoth companies like the NBA and Disney, both of which have business partnerships with the Emirates," end quote. I should note the UAE denies involvements. Can you talk, John, about the evidence you have to the contrary and why they're supporting the RSF?
Well, I think there are many reasons why they're supporting the RSF. And it's, we'd look back, the audience would remember during the Cold War when the United States and the Soviet Union sort of competed around the world on the chessboard of the globe. And it was a fairly straightforward competition. There were other actors, but they weren't remotely as dominant as the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Now, for example, the way it's unfolding in the region which Sudan finds itself or is geographically straddling the Red Sea, where so much of the world's commercial traffic transits, there are middle powers, as they call them, newly emerging powers: Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, Iran, and others, who are competing for influence and using massive transfers of arms as a way to buy that influence all throughout that region. And Sudan is no exception. It has been, I think, it would have been torn apart at some level by an intra-Sudan war, a civil war, but because it's been locked on by all these external actors, it's been completely supercharged, and the level of weaponry has become so much more deadly. And the United Arab Emirates sees that competition with Saudi Arabia and Egypt and others to ensure its foothold along the Red Sea in that region. It wants land for agricultural production, to feed its people. It wants the gold that Swad talked about. Billions of dollars of gold are flowing into the coffers in Dubai. So there are multiple objectives. And now they're in so deep, it's hard for them to extract. If they extract and stop supporting it, even, you'd think, my God, what are you getting out of this? Now you're, more and more attention's being, but it's, there would be quite a black eye for the UAE if its sort of chosen proxy were to be completely defeated by the Sudan army. So they're probably not going to give up without a lot more pressure.
We need to take a break in a moment here, and we'll continue this conversation on the other side of that. But briefly, in about 30 seconds, if you can, tell me about the United States' role here. There's I understand, legislation from Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs, Senator Chris Van Hollen, that would cut U.S. arms sales to the UAE. What is the United States' involvement here?
Yeah, that's the legislative branch. Oh, sorry, Swad, do you want to go first?
Yeah, just want to a quick note. Despite the United States, despite widespread documentation and even acknowledgement of the UAE's role by United States officials, by lawmakers, and by U.S. intelligence, the U.S. continues to be the main arms manufacturer to the UAE because the UAE does not manufacture its own arms. And in fact, the U.S. has only increased defense coordination and arms sales to the UAE under the Trump administration since the RSF siege began. As a human rights lawyer, I want to make this clear. Continuing to send weapons to the United Arab Emirates while it arms this genocidal militia is not just immoral, it is illegal under international law and under US law. Under the Arms Trade Treaty, to which the United States is a signatory, it has a legal obligation to halt its arms export, given that there is a clear risk that these weapons will be used to commit war crimes and genocide.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We will continue this conversation on what's happening in Sudan. My guests for the first part of the program today are Swad Abdelaziz, who is a human rights lawyer, and John Prendergast, who is an advocate on these matters. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about what has been happening in Sudan. It's been called a civil war. A group known as the Rapid Support Forces, which has been called an Arab supremacist group, has enacted a campaign of mass violence across the country, specifically on Sudan's minority black ethnic groups. Former American Secretary of State Antony Blinken called it a genocide before leaving office this January. The BBC has reported 150,000 people have been killed there. An estimated 12 million have been displaced. We're talking about that with John Prendergast, co-founder of The Century, which is an investigative and advocacy organization. Also, The Enough Project, which aims to end mass violence in some of Africa's conflict zones. He was also director of African affairs at the National Security Council under President Bill Clinton. Also, Swad Abdelaziz, a human rights lawyer and executive director of the group Decolonize Sudan. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. So, John, maybe you can talk a little bit then. Before the break, we were talking about the United States' role in arming the United Arab Emirates, which is in turn providing weapons, although that country denies it, but is providing weapons to the RSF, the group that's carrying out these atrocities. Talk about this legislation and what it would do and whether, you know, how you would assess its prospects.
Well, let's be very clear. There are few co-sponsors. It's really unlikely that the legislative branch influences the Trump administration to do anything on anything. And this is not going to move the needle. It's very, very important that that symbolic statement is made, but the United States is not going to stop selling weapons to the Emirates. You think about all the business dealings the Trump family has with the Emirati royal family. It's just very complicated.
Talk about that, because I think most people, you know, going about their lives, there's so much happening in the world. I think people may
it's
not.
It's true.
It's the one. Is that the one with the jet? Is that the one with the crypto?
I know.
Talk more about it.
Yeah, that's the one with the crypto and other things and lots of commercial real estate deals and other kinds of things. But it's billions of dollars, not millions. And so the U.S. this administration, this family has gone in league with the Saudis, the Qataris, the Emiratis on a number of business interests. But there are also geopolitical reasons why the United States is not going to lean too hard on the United Arab Emirates because of the role that the Emirates plays in the Gaza diplomacy, the role that the Emirates plays in the Abraham Accords, trying to get Gulf countries to and other countries around the world to recognize the existence of Israel. The right of Israel's sovereignty, et cetera. And so there's just many reasons why. So you have to look back, I think, in terms of the U.S. executive branch role, more at what they're doing diplomatically, because the U.S. does have leverage, major leverage with the United Arab Emirates, with Saudi Arabia, with Egypt, the main actors who are backing the parties in Sudan. And with that leverage, the US, if it expends it, mostly quietly, we're not going to see a lot of shouting from the rooftops like we saw with the last administration. I think the US could potentially play a role in bringing to bear some form of agreement amongst the external parties, who are the main external parties who are backing governments, backing the belligerents in Sudan, excluding Iran, because Iran is also involved, very complicated, as I said. But at the end of the day, the US could play a significant role in helping to bring about an end to the fighting. And that is what I think the primary possibility, upside possibility that exists, is that US diplomacy working diligently, using leverage with the external parties, could bring about some kind of a ceasefire. Anything beyond that, I highly doubt, but that's my view. Swad may have a very different view on that, but it's something that's a live ball right now.
Yeah, Swad, what do you think? Where are the leverage points? If John was saying this legislation that I mentioned, very unlikely to move the needle here. Where are the leverage points in the United States? Swad, are you with us? I think you might be muted there.
Yes, I am. That's
Okay.
right. So our organization, Decolonize Sudan, has pushed for, along with organizations like the Council on American Islamic Relations, the National Lawyers Guild, Refugees International, and other organizations, where we've put out statements urgently calling on the State Department to suspend arms to the UAE, for Congress to pass this UAE arms embargo bill, which has growing support amongst Congress people in both the Senate and the House. This Stand Up for Sudan Act, which was introduced by Representative Sarah Jacobs in the House and Chris Van Hollen in the Senate. We demand that are no more empty condemnations around what's happening in Sudan, and instead, for the U.S. to meet its obligations, its duty to stop the flow of arms fueling the genocide in Sudan now. And you're the listeners, as constituents, you have the power to pressure your congresspeople to do this, to prohibit the State Department from sending these arms on within your using your tax dollars. And so there's an ongoing campaign that CARE and others have put together, and there's a link at bit.ly/sanctionRSF, where constitu you know there's a they make it very easy for you to speak directly to your congresspeople about this issue with a script and pre-filled messages that where you can speak on what's happening and why you don't want the arms flow to continue. A ceasefire in Sudan is the Rapid Support Forces has violated each and every ceasefire agreement that it has entered into, most recently after completely annihilating the people of Al-Fashir. The RSF made a so-called ceasefire announcement, a truce announcement. And within one day of announcing this so-called truce, the RSF launched drone strikes on key cities around Sudan, including Dilling, Al-Ubaid, and Umm Durman, and attacked a displacement camp in Al-Ubaid, which importantly, the RSF is going to be targeting next in a similar style that it has targeted Al-Fashid. And so we have a duty to the people of Sudan and to humanity to stop this now. The announcement by any announcements of ceasefire by this genocidal militia that is not a political entity, that is not a diplomatic entity, but a militia intent on annihilating the people of Sudan is incompatible with in tackling this genocide. We call for an immediate arms embargo on the UAE, and we will work to until this is done.
John, I know your time is limited. If you have if you do have time for one more question, I was hoping to ask you, because I know you've worked with George Clooney. I'm old enough to remember 20 years ago, Darfur. A lot of Americans could talk about Darfur, who I think today are just not connected to this issue the way, you know, you see Ukraine flags, you see Palestine flags flying in America. Why do you think that is? Why is there such a disconnect?
Well, there was an amazing outpouring of compassion for people halfway around the world in the 2000s by Americans of all stripes and all political backgrounds. It was a very bipartisan movement, and young and old as well. And it was very closely involved the religious communities and others. And it really was a beautiful thing to see. It's hard to replicate that, you know, 20 years later, the sort of same dynamic is at play. People like, well, I did that already. I was already part of that. I don't understand what's wrong. And it sort of plays into the stereotypes that people hear all the time. Well, Africa is just a lost cause of why. But I'm so glad that SWAT has been giving your listeners an idea that they can still take action. You don't have to kind of go marching in the streets. Perhaps that's too much to expect at this moment in time, but to write, sign petitions and to write letters, very simple actions can be taken that can make a difference. And, you know, this legislation, though it probably won't pass, though it probably won't force the administration to change its policy, what it does do is it embarrasses the United Arab Emirates. It creates reputational damage with the UAE. And that is going to influence their calculations as to how long and how hard they are going to support this genocidal militia in Sudan.
Well, Swad Abdel Aziz, human rights lawyer, executive director of Decolonize Sudan, and John Prendergast, co-founder of The Century, founding director of the Enough Project. Thank you both so much for being with us and sharing your expertise with us today on the 21st show.
I'm very glad you did this show. Thank you, Brian.
And I'll say John and Swad both, again, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. It's called Sudan is in Free Fall. We'll have a link to that at our website if you want to learn more.